Formula One by Peter Nygaard. Since the first world championship in 1950, Formula One has held racing fans enthralled around the world. In his book, Motorsport, historian, photographer and collector, Peter Nygaard opens his exclusive archives for the first time to tell the stories of the illustrious history of West One. Delighted to be joining me from somewhere in Denmark, I should imagine, is Peter himself. Peter, good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Whereabouts are you in? Are you today?
I am in my hometown of Haslev, which is sort of 60 kilometers south of Copenhagen.
Very nice indeed. Now, normally when I interview people and we do it on the Zoom as we're doing here, they'll have some sort of background. They'll have some sort of something that they've put up themselves. It could be either it's their studio, like I am at the moment. It can be their office, and sometimes it's a background of perhaps, I know, a desert island and whatever. And I was talking to Peter just off air, and the screen was black, and it came up, and Peter. So what is exactly sitting behind you as I look at you on the screen?
That is a genuine Formula One car from the 1993 season. This is my office.
You've got a Formula One car sitting in your office.
That's correct.
Because
some people think it's my living room, but I'm sure my wife would disagree with that. That would not be very important.
Tell me a little bit about then how you became, because it describes you as a historian, photographer and collector. Now, if you're going to be something, a Formula One historian is probably my dream job. So tell me a bit about how, because, you know, Denmark has had Grand Prix in its time as well, and there have been some well-known races coming out of Denmark. But what sparked your enthusiasm into the world of F1?
To be honest, I don't really know. But I've been fascinated by Formula One since I was a very young boy, 8, 9, 10 years. And then I very quickly decided I wanted to work in Formula One. That was a bit of a problem to convince the career advisor at high school that I wanted to be a Formula One journalist. But I studied law for all the wrong reasons. And when I qualified as a lawyer, I wanted to take half a year sabbatical to try to follow Formula One before I went into a boring law office. And that is half sabbatical year. That is still running now 40 years later.
So what was the first proper F1 Grand Prix you attended then? Can you remember where it was and what it was?
I remember very quickly my first Formula One race as a young fan, as a boy, was in 1974 in Sweden. And that was I had only been at the circuit for half an hour when I was convinced I have to work in this crazy circus. So that was 74 as a fan.
And that would be Andersorp then, presumably. In
Andersorp, yeah. And then my first race with a proper press credential was the Belgian Grand Prix 1982, which was a tragic race, of course, because it was when Gilles Villeneuve lost his life.
The infamous Zolder, the Grand Prix. So you've been covering Grand Prix since then. A lot of people cover Grand Prix and they don't sort of look back, because the sport has changed so much, obviously, in 70 years, as anyone would. But if you go to a football match or a rugby match or a cricket match or whatever, tennis match, it's still pretty much the same thing. It's still the same ground, the same stadium. But Formula One, since that first World Championship Grand Prix in 1950 through to now, has changed ridiculously over 72 years. I mean, even if you look at the circuits, the safety, the fans, the access to the competitors, I mean, it has changed beyond all recognition. So what sparks your interest in the history, as it were, of F1?
I think history is what makes Formula One unique, because we have other racing championships and categories where the cars are maybe faster, maybe more overtaking, but they don't have the history of Formula One. For me, it's incredibly fascinating to go to, say, Monza or Silverstone and know that in 1950-51, my big heroes, Fangio and Farina and all those guys, they raced here. And that's why I also prefer the classic races, the classic circuits, much more than the modern circuits. They're very nice. It's great to go to Abu Dhabi. I have aircon in the pit lane, but it's just not the same atmosphere, the same sense of history that you have at the classic circuits.
And I've interviewed people about F1 quite a few times on these shows, but one of the things in the way that it started in 1950 is the way that it had, if you like, you see the change, because in 1950 you have pretty much the cars painted in the colors of their nationality. So the Ferraris and the Lancias are red, you know, the German cars are the French cars are blue, the German cars can be white or silver, whatever, and the camaraderie between the drivers, because as I always say, on the back of a pass when you go to a motor racing meeting, it always says motor racing is dangerous, and it still is. But in the 50s, it was not only dangerous, it was frequently fatal.
Yeah, and I think we have to be honest with ourselves. The danger is part of the attraction of Formula One and motor racing in general. It's not that anybody wants to see drivers getting hurt or anything. But it's just, it makes it a little bit more interesting, fascinating again, that if you make a mistake in tennis, okay, you lose a point or whatever. If you make a mistake in Formula One, the consequences are far bigger. Hopefully not with any injuries to the driver, but at least financially, it's a bit more costly to make a mistake in a Formula One car than with a tennis racket.
And
that is part of the danger, part of the fascination, I think. People like to see the competitors doing something that they can't and they wouldn't do because it's too freaking dangerous.
And if you look at the way that the sport has evolved as well, so in the 50s, you've got the Ferraris, the Maseratis, you've got the Van Wolves, you've got the privateers getting involved as well, you know, and there's great names, Fangio, Fanier, you know, Musso, Collins, Hawthorne, etc. And then in the 60s, Enzo Ferrari gets well, and you know, this is, we're an English language radio station, and so in the 60s, you got what Enzo called, you know, the garagistas came, you know, the Lotuses, the Brabhams, the small cars, and we had that British Revolution through the 60s with Surtees, you know, with Clark, the great Clark, with Hill. And then in the 70s, it becomes more commercial. And we get this, the Fittipaldi is coming in as well, the great Swede, Ronnie Peterson coming in. And we get that South American through to the 80s, and we get Piquet and Prost and Mansell, and of course, Ayrton. I mean, it really, and the whole structure. So it's a fluid and evolving history. So how do you structure a book like that to make it so that people can understand what's going on and that the beating heart of Formula One is still the beating heart that started in 1950?
Yeah, it was quite difficult to find the structure to say, and the layout of the book. But in the end, we decided, why not start with the first World Championship season and then let it evolve from there, season by season or decade by decade, but also looking at the various aspects like the technology, how did that develop in each decade, and the most famous drivers from each decade, and of course we have portraits of all the world champions.
And of course, you talk about how things have changed, but if you look at the modern Grand Prix driver, and we've followed them all on the social media, but I was watching George Russell, who will be racing for Mercedes for the first time this year, and he's doing some exercise with his neck, he's pulling for the G. And then you think of drivers in 1950, and you think of, you know, the old man Fangio at 47 in a polo shirt, or Fania, who was this big Argentinian guy who looked like he could be a butcher. He wasn't exactly the slim size of a racing driver, of a modern racing driver, was he?
No, and it's sort of underlines how the sport has developed, that everything is getting optimized all the time. I mean, to begin with, the Formula One was all about engines. You had the most powerful engine, and you basically put four wheels on the engine, and that was it. Then they found out maybe the car should be handling better. Then they realized there are some things called wind resistance, and then realized aerodynamics could be a decisive factor. And not so long ago, maybe say mid-90s, and Michael Schumacher was the first who realized that the driver's fitness was also important. It's not that the drivers before Schumacher were not fit. They were all fairly fit, but he just took it to another level. And today, all drivers are fit like Michael was in his great days.
It's funny, isn't it? You see these pictures of Keke Rosberg, or of Keke Rosberg famously said that the only training a driver needed was to be a Formula One driver, was to drive a Formula One car. And there are hundreds of photographs of James Hunt smoking a cigarette seconds before getting into a racing car, and the way that whole, I suppose, as the sport grew up, it became more professional and more commercial, and so those perhaps the playboys and the privateers, for example, were gradually eased out of the sport.
Yeah, as I said, it's about optimizing every tiny details. And what comes next, you may ask. We have now developed the physics of the drivers to the optimum, probably. I'm sure mental training is going to play a significant role in the future, because there's also maybe a tenth or a hundredth of a second to be gained there. So they're going after that also.
Yeah, that's an interesting.
That's what makes it also so great, isn't it?
Well, I wait to see. We'll see a couple of racing drivers perhaps doing a few mind training exercises and getting their zen before getting out. I mean, visualization has always been important, and Michael would also sort of visualize the first couple of corners.
Yeah. So as I said, you have to optimize every tiny details, and it's not just about the car and the technology and the tires. It's also about the human body.
How difficult is it to put together, to write and bring something fresh to the battles that we've known so much about? For example, we can talk about, you know, the famous ones, which is going to be, you know, Senna-Prost, for example, which is perhaps the most famous battle between, you know, two great drivers, or looking back and seeing, you know, that golden eye, one of my favorite areas, which is the mid to late 60s, when you've got, you know, you've got Rindt, you've got Stewart, you've got Clark, you've got Graham Hill, you've got Dan Gurney, and they're all competing at such a high level. There's been lots written about that. So how do you present it in a fresh way? I know that you had access to lots of archive and lots of photographs, for example.
The photographs is obviously one way. We have tried, I think we have succeeded in finding photographs which has not been seen before for the vast majority. They have never been published before. And that is, of course, important in a book like this. It's not no good showing the people the same pictures they have seen in other books previously. But for the text, I think it was very important for me to have spoken to most of the drivers from the past. I've been very fortunate to join the Grand Prix Drivers Club, who is for old Formula One drivers, at a few of their annual meetings. And it's just incredibly information you can get there. I mean, current Formula One drivers are nice to talk to, but they are always very politically correct. They only say what the sponsors and the team managers and what people expect of them. But once they retire, the drivers sort of open up, and that's when the good, interesting stuff comes out.
I can imagine speaking to a Gerhard Berger or speaking to Mika Häkkinen or Keke or somebody like Emerson Fittipaldi or somebody from those days. Must be a very interesting experience, because as you said, today's drivers are completely on message in a way perhaps those of the 80s and 70s perhaps weren't.
That is very true. So once a driver retires, I look him up as fast as possible to get the real story, to get the truth behind the stories which we were presented to while he was driving.
There's always people always going about the tragedy. I think it's a picture of Castellotti on the front of the book. Is that in with the Ferrari? I think that may be correct.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking, because that's, you know, there's that tragedy, that 57 season. But there's also humor, isn't there, in Formula One? At the end of the day, you know, the drivers, though they may be competitive on track, some of them get on very, very well together. They may not all like Eddie Irvine, but most of them get on quite well together.
Yeah, I mean, what's really interested me and what attracted me to Formula One in the beginning was not really the cars. Okay, they are high tech, they are nice to look at, they're very fast, of course, but the real attraction for me are the drivers, because they are really special human beings. Some are perhaps more brave than clever, but they are all very special human beings, and that is you don't get into Formula One without doing something very special and having made a lot of sacrifice along the way.
And the other interesting thing is that you know, we talked about the tracks and the fact that you like classic racing and historic racing a bit more, but as I said before, you can go out on some of these tracks. I mean, you know, Abu Dhabi is very nice and Saudi is very nice, and they've all been designed to be to whatever they are. But you can go out to Spa, for example. You can go to Monza, and you can stand there, and you can almost listen to the cars and peel back, or just get that sense of, you know, or the old ring of the history that has gone on. You know, I mean, and really feel that history as if it's there in your hand.
Well, it is more or less in your hands. At least it's in your mind very quickly, because you can see this is the same corner, exactly the same corner that Jim Clark or whoever drove through 50 years ago.
It's always you're going to get asked this question, but they always say, you know, who was the greatest of all time? But again, it's different cars, it's different circumstances, it's different eras. But you know, you said that F1 drivers are special. You know, some are more special than others, and there have always been those drivers who have been just that little bit above. You know, as Senna famously said, you know, when he looked through the envelope and he was driving in another place, and you mentioned Jim Clark, and you mentioned Fangio, and you mentioned Schumacher, and there are those drivers, aren't there? Hamilton, who are going to stand out through the ages when we look back, and who are the best of the best.
Is that the question? Who is the best of the best? Because I have a very clear answer to that.
Okay.
I just come back from holiday in Argentina. And Argentina is, of course, a Fangio country. And yeah, we went to the museum in his hometown, Balcarce. And if I was in any doubt before, I'm now definitely sure that Fangio is the greatest driver in Formula 1 history.
Well,
and you just have to look at the statistics. I think he did 51 World Championship races. And he won 24 of them.
Yeah.
That's almost half of them.
And not
been very impressive that Lewis has done recently, what Michael did, what Ayrton did, Jim Clark also, all fantastic, great drivers. But what Fangio did was special. And you have to remember, in those days, as we discussed earlier, it was not only dangerous, it was very often very fatal for a lot of drivers. And he never made big mistakes. And today, it's very spectacular. It's very dramatic. It gives us a lot of TV viewers when Max and Hamilton crash together. But you never saw Fangio. You never saw Fangio put his driver in a dangerous position. He was a gentleman on the track. And if you can win half of your races and still be a gentleman, you must do something special. Plus, he won those five world championships with four different teams, which also says a bit about him.
Absolutely.
So I'm a big Fangio fan. You can hear that.
You can hear that. And the other thing is, if you get the chance, because I'm on YouTube, I think it's at Phillip Island, but there's Fangio and Jack Brabham, and they're supposed to be doing a demonstration run, and Fangio's in the Mercedes, and Jack Brabham's in, I think it's his 1967 Repco Brabham, and what starts off as a demonstration drive turns into this absolute scrap, and you see the crowd going absolutely wild, because it's supposed to be an exhibition.
And Fangio is what, 75
yeah,
at the time?
Yeah. And the mechanics and the commentators are going, I don't believe this. If you have to highlight an era, if you have to say to you, because I just said my favorite period is going to be 1964 to maybe 73, you know, when Stewart wins his last world championship, tragic circumstances, etc. But the you know, you still had the privateers, you still had Rob Walker winning the final privateer Grand Prix with Joe Siffert, for example. And that's all those sort of teams who you could get involved. You just put a Cosworth in the back of your car and off you went. But what would you say your favorite era is? Is it that 50s with Fangio, with Collins, with Hawthorns, with Musso, with
I would have loved to experience the 50s. That must have been a very special era. And I think the camaraderie between the drivers and the whole atmosphere was probably much better than, it was definitely very different from what it is today. Sorry. But from the eras I have experienced myself, I would say the late 70s, early 80s are fantastic. That was when I started in the sport, when I became interested in the sport. And if you're young and impressionable, it's just something incredible. But if you do Formula One this season will be my 42nd season in Formula One professionally. So if you do it for so long, you always have to stay motivated. And the only way to do that is to believe strongly that the next season is going to be the best ever.
And so with the season coming up, hopefully, and, you know, perhaps Sir Lewis Hamilton might just turn up. Do you think we're in for a Do you think we're in for a vintage season as well this season coming up, Peter?
Yes, we have five new cars, which should allow for even closer racing than before. And it was not that last year was a boring or we lacked close racing, even with the cars which were believed to be not so good for close racing. We had a fantastic season, and I can see this season coming up being even better.
We'll look forward to that. This book is called Formula One. It's out now. It's by Peter Nygaard, who we've been speaking to today. Peter, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you have your own website? Do you do the social media thing? Do you have pictures of that car behind you on social media?
We probably have, yeah. Our website with the pictures are called GrandPrixPhoto.com, very easily. And on Instagram, I'm Peter Nygaard F1.
Well, Pete, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. My face, when the Zoom came on and I saw that sitting behind you, I wish I'd taken a screenshot of my face. But this book, congratulations on the book. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a worthy book. Peter Nygaard, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.